KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
We've got music from every flavor, so keep it tuned on 91.9 on that FM dial where you can turn on, tune in, and jam out.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, June 2nd, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebeck with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Uro.
And this week, we're going to be talking about the spotfin chub, which has a pretty unassuming name for a remarkably beautiful fish.
We've got two guests, Luke Etchison and Pat Ciccato. Pat's joining us from Warren Wilson College in North Carolina, and Luke from the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Very excited to finally cover this fish, and really appreciate you guys being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Okay, so I always think it's cool when we talk about a fish that's the only one in its genus, and I was hoping maybe one of you could help us understand where it fits on the fish family tree, and maybe the other could help us visualize what it looks like given that context, because it is a really cool-looking fish.
This is obviously a really interesting fish, and it's had a fairly interesting taxonomic history. It's actually been placed in several different genera over the course of the years since its original description. Some authors have recognized it in the genus Cyprinella, Hybopsis, Aramystax. Most recently, it is recognized, as you mentioned, Katrina, in a monotypic genus, Aramonax. The issue is that it has this really interesting combination of characters that actually is part of the reason why the species was called Monaca in the first place by Edward Cope when he described it. For one, he only found a handful of individuals in his collections, but also just sort of the unique features of its morphology. It looks like some other shiners that you'd see here in western North Carolina in the upper Tennessee basin, specifically those in the genus Cyprinella. So thinking about probably some of the more familiar species like spotfin shiners and whitetail shiners and satinfin shiners. It has these diamond-shaped scales similar to that group. The males will have breeding tubercles on the top of the head extending down to the snout. And there's also some other characteristics which may not be the easiest to see for those who are maybe snorkeling or seeing this fish in an aquarium or in the wild. In light of that, it'll be very easy to identify if you have a breeding male since they're so vividly blue, and I'm not really sure what else you could confuse it with. But of course, when teaching fish ID, we always want to teach the identifications of the non-breeding individuals so that you could identify this fish throughout the year. The scale shape is helpful, the general shape of the snout, and the fact that it has maxillary barbels, so those are just little sort of tendrils, these thin structures in the corner of the mouth that distinguish it from other Cyprinella-type shiners that I mentioned previously.
Where's the spot?
The spot is on the posterior part of the dorsal fin, also similar to what we see in other species of Cyprinella, which also led to why it may have been originally placed in that genus.
Could you describe the breeding male a little bit? Because it really stands out, and it has some patterning on it that I've never seen in really any other fish. Derek Wheaton with CFI had been showing me, I think, the first photos of a breeding male I'd ever seen, and I thought that that was just like dappling from the water, but apparently it's like the actual coloration of the fish. I'll let you describe it for folks.
Yeah, so overall, the breeding males have this really unique turquoise blue, metallic blue sheen to them. But they also can get some of these white bars that originate on the underside or ventral aspect of the fish as well. That's really unique, and I can't think of anything else you might confuse it with. And that white coloration is also seen in some other shiner species as well, but never that degree of that metallic blue.
Sounds beautiful.
They're unbelievably like reflective. It's like blinding blue out of the corner of your eye when you're snorkeling.
So you're going into some of these other genera that the spotfin chub has been lumped in with before, and one of them stands out, Cyprinella, because they're crevice spawners. And as I understand it, this fish does that as well. So I was wondering, could you describe the breeding behavior of these fish, what it needs, how the males interact with one another, how they court females?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, these fishes will look for a small crack or fissure in rocks or in logs. Bedrock is a pretty common one What the male will do is defend breeding territories around these crevices. And while doing that, it'll be attracting females and also competing with mates for access to those females as well. The eggs will then be deposited in the crevice and fertilized by the male. The male will then continue courting with other females. It's really interesting because there's lots of diversity in terms of how minnows, the leuciscids, spawn in North America. Many are broadcast spawners, so by that we mean they deposit their eggs and sperm kind of broadly in these aquatic environments. Of course, we have the mound builders like the river chubs and the bluehead chubs that build these giant piles of rocks. We have some minnows that make pits as well. The crevice spawning is really unique to the Supernal as well as Eremonax and a couple other genera. That also makes them a unique component of our stream ecosystems. When we think about the fact that these shiners are so imperiled, part of the reason is due to sedimentation that can fill in these crevices or cracks that can limit their opportunities for this type of spawning.
I'm trying to imagine kind of in my head, it sounds like a really neat looking fish, some neat behavior. What is it like to actually be at the habitat where these fish are? What's it like to see them kind of in their native range out in the wild?
One of the problems is they're not found in very many places, but luckily we have two rivers in North Carolina, the Little Tennessee River and the Chioa River, where you can regularly see them. Most of the good photos on the internet from the Chioa, because it's almost always clear, it's like a topwater release. The stream is right below a dam, and there's lots of really good bedrock, and so they're basically super saturated in there. It's awesome because, you know, perfectly clear water, you're on this like pristine bedrock, and there's a lot of really cool cracks in the bedrock. I have multiple videos of them spawning in there. Whitetails are, you know, way more common than spot fins in Western North Carolina, but they are very abundant in the Chio as well. They're constantly having male spot fins just chase them off. They're constantly fighting with each other. It's pretty entertaining to see. It's awesome because when they're really small, you could probably confuse them with maybe some of the other Cyprinella for sure. One of the real easy things to do, how we identify like the juveniles, is you can always see it by their feeding behavior. If you watch them long enough and you don't know what it is, they'll eventually start feeding on the bottom. Whitetails really don't do that. Spot fins are just cruising on the bottom. They're definitely a very benthic feeder by comparison. It's pretty cool, entertaining to snorkel with them.
So I have to key in on this sediment thing that Pat said, because, you know, originally we were going to record this episode back in the fall or winter, and then a major event happened, Hurricane Helene, tons of sediment put in the water. How has that hurricane and the sediment put into the rivers affected the distribution and the habitat for this fish?
Luckily, the two places we have them really had minimal hurricane damage. The Little Tennessee River, it's around 20 miles of habitat for them. Basically, the eye went over that section, so it didn't really get near as much rain as it did to the east where Pat and I live. So their habitats, luckily, they're still there. They're still happy. Habitat's relatively unchanged. You know, one of the reasons we initially wanted to talk about spot fins for this episode is we've been trying to get a reintroduction going in the Swannanoa River, which Warren Wilson College has. I think it's like a mile and a half of river frontage on campus. We've been working at this a long time. We're trying to build momentum for that. And then basically, you know, the Swannanoa got hit about as hard as anywhere and definitely set everything back. And Swannanoa is cool about that. It's one of the few places we have historical records of spot fins in North Carolina. Assumption is they were everywhere, but we have records of them in Swannanoa. So definitely set back that, and probably going to put reintroductions in the Swannanoa in the back burner until we kind of figure out what habitat's like in the Swannanoa and other places in the French Broad River watershed. Generally speaking, it's really interesting. There's a lot of systems we've been in so far where you really didn't have a lot of exposed bedrock, and now all of a sudden you have quite a bit. Scoured sections went down to the bedrock. It'll be interesting to see what habitat availability is like.
I've been taking my students out there to do fish and vertebrate and water quality monitoring. Is very regularly very turbid and difficult to see through. It's definitely struggling with a lot of runoff because of all destruction to the riparian vegetation. So there is some concern about continued sedimentation. But as Luke mentioned, in areas when it is clear enough to see the bottom, we have some really potentially nice bedrock areas that could be used by spot fin chubs.
Could one of you describe the status of the fish? Like, how is it doing officially?
Yeah, spot fin chubs are federally threatened. The Holston, Emory, the Little Tennessee, and Buffalo. Those are basically the only places they occur there's been some reintroduced populations. Actually, the Chioa is a reintroduced population. There's been a few examples of where they've done really well after reintroductions if the habitat's there. You know, we're feeling really optimistic. If we could get them in the water in some new places, some places they used to be, they'd really take off. That kind of short-lived minnow, you're going to be able to tell if it was successful basically immediately.
You don't have to wait like 20 years or anything like that.
Yeah, so when the Chioa, I think it was just like a handful of years. We haven't stocked there in a couple of years, and we're estimating more than 8,000 individuals. We're optimistic about their recovery as long as we can find the funds to get CFI to propagate them and get the approval to put them places. They do a lot of site feeding, so that's another barrier for extra turbidity coming in these systems from a big storm like Helene. So many unknowns, but there's still a lot of good places out there, and we still have a ton of places to get clear really quick. Just maybe the Swanano is going to be a little on the back burner for now.
What are the kind of suite of factors that have led to that decline?
Sedimentation historically has been the issue, filling in those gaps with having unsuccessful reproduction because of that, and then the site feeding component. The bigger problem now is that they are where they are and they're stuck between dams. They're really in good shape where they are now. It's scary to just have a population downstream of an over 100-year-old dam. Because you never know what can happen. You know, if Helene would have just shifted a little bit different, like we could have lost a whole population in a night. The biggest threat, I think, is just their restricted range due to dams.
You mentioned the role of CFI in these reintroduction efforts. Is that the only source of fish for reintroductions? Do you do any wild transfer? And then how do you consider which populations of fish to move into a certain river?
The only tool we have had previously for improving conservation of spotfin chubs is working with Conservation Fisheries in Knoxville. They're a nonprofit. They specialize in rare and cryptic fish propagation, and they're definitely key. If you have a rare thing that's only found in a few places, they've been propagating spotfin chubs. We use broodstock from the Little Tennessee River. They've really figured it out. We're kind of at this point in the Chioa River where it doesn't need much. It just needs some genetic augmentation.
I took a tour of CFI once, and the chubs were spawning there, and they basically had these tiles like stacked up to mimic these crevices that they could spawn into. I was amazed at how far they could project their eggs into these crevices. Like, we're talking like probably 3x3, maybe 4x4-inch tiles, and they're able to shoot these things into the middle. Oh. It is quite impressive.
It makes total sense, and that's awesome. Our agency and Fish and Wildlife Service have been working together. We established this safe harbor agreement, which is essentially a way to minimize regulatory burden and get folks on board for letting us stock on their property. So the idea is that you can stock animals and landowners won't have that regulatory burden. Baseline for this would be zero, so you can't get below zero, so they would be protected from whatever happens to the species. There's just a lot of steps in the process, and it's complicated because we think that some of these places we could put spotfins, they could really expand. There's a lot of complicated things like how do you handle it 30 years down the road when you can find them 50 miles upstream.
Yeah. Pat, I'm curious, how are you planning to keep your students interested and involved with this fish in the meantime while the system's maybe coming back to normal state here at some point?
It's a good question. We had Chub Fest planned for right during the hurricane. Of course, that was when we were about to originally record this too. You know, there was some real disappointment with that being canceled, and obviously with what a disaster Helene's been in terms of the stream ecosystem. Our students are extremely engaged in conserving our native ecosystems, our native fishes. So I think generating excitement won't be an issue. Our students are going to be more than willing to help lend a hand. Prior to the storm, I was working with Luke with some other translocation projects into the Swan Hill River with some more common species. So we actually did a translocation of greenside darters into the river on campus because they're present below a dam further downstream. The first round was a great success, and we had that excitement. And then, of course, Helene hit, so we put that on hold. As Luke mentioned, we tried to figure out what's going on from a habitat standpoint in the river itself right now. Currently, I have students helping me out with field surveys just to get some baseline data to figure out what fish species are still present throughout the Swanano River watershed.
At a smaller college like Warren Wilson, what are some of the advantages and disadvantages for folks like yourself or for students wanting to research or work with fishes like the spotfin chub?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the really great advantages with a smaller school is the smaller class sizes. we are able to do field excursions very easily compared to, say, you know, a class of 50 or more. And our focus at the college in particular is with community engagement. So as we design our courses, a lot of us as faculty here think about what community partners we can engage with. And I think that's part of the reason why it's been such a successful relationship with Luke and his group, that we're able to partner with the professional biologists, share data, collect data with classes, figure out where do we need to focus efforts and where potentially myself and my students can help out with their overall goals of conserving native fishes in the area. We don't have graduate students who might be able to do more focused research on things like spot fin chub, but our students do have to do a capstone project to graduate. And so we do have lots of opportunities for students to engage in research projects where they can really focus in on particular areas of interest. And I think importantly, too, is we can get undergraduates excited and trained to potentially go into these careers, go into graduate school. We have some Wilson students who are actually working with Luke right now through technician positions and internships as well. That's facilitated by this connection with our community partners at the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about snorkeling and how it can be used both to kind of actually monitor maybe a fish like this and also engage community members in seeing these really cool fish that you guys got that you might not be able to actually angle for in some of that kind of traditional engagement sense.
It's interesting. One of the things that I routinely encounter, and I'm sure Luke would say the same thing, whether it be with people in the community or students, is an initial lack of awareness of fish diversity in our part of the world. Here in the southeastern United States, in particular in the Tennessee River watershed that we're part of, we have this incredible diversity, as I'm sure you all and your listeners know as well. I think one of the best ways to get an appreciation for that is to be in their habitats and be in the water, observing them spawning and eating and just swimming and just getting a true appreciation of what these animals look like and what their behavior is like. That, to me, really can't be conveyed in any more effective format. I mean, we can talk and talk and come up with creative outreach materials, which are wonderful, but seeing these fishes in their actual native environment really inspires students and community members in a way that I think is very difficult to replicate.
With spotfin chubs, they're real sensitive to electricity. Where they're at, we try and minimize how much we're using our backpack electrofisher. Folks have been snorkeling for spotfin chubs for a long time, and we developed a methodology for monitoring by just snorkel surveys. One of my collaborators, Jason Dahl at Francis Marion in South Carolina, he's a stats guru and professional fish nerd too. He helped us develop the methods behind that technique, and we're able to basically do targeted snorkel surveys for them and come up with population estimates. You basically start downstream of your set distance, 50, 100, you know, 200 meters, whatever size the stream is, and slowly work your way upstream. We make little armbands out of basically PVC pipe that we cut in half and connect with like rubber tubing. We use as like a riding slate, mark, you know, number of fish we see and whether they're subadults or adults and what habitat you're finding them over. You know, you can electrofish something and it can be over bedrock, but you really don't know if they're using it, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's the awesome thing about snorkeling. It's why I've been hooked on it for so long. Having a cool fish in your hand is awesome, but you don't really feel as connected to it as you would snorkeling and seeing it in its habitat doing its thing. It's definitely the cool thing about our sampling for that species. It really can't be done very effectively without snorkeling.
And to add to that too, there's just some habitats you just can't electrofish insane effectively that really you can only detect these species just by snorkeling, whether it's like a deep pool or just somewhere that's just so inaccessible with any other gear type.
Graduate student, her name's Atlee at Western Carolina University. She's doing a master's project on spotfin chubs. Last year, we're dropping washers with little flags on them to mark habitat where we found spotfin chubs. And she was coming up behind and measuring the habitat for her project. And there's a site where we had missed a couple of washers. They're still in the spot that we left them. And we came back the next day. And sure enough, like exactly where that washer was, the fish were. It's just really cool to be able to see that and capture their whole essence of what they're doing underwater.
Less invasive and probably really fun as well.
Yeah, cool. It's definitely one of our more fun things we do.
So speaking about snorkeling and getting people from the public involved, you know, I'm actually teaching this course down at UGA, helping to teach it. And we took this kid snorkeling for the first time, and one thing that stood out that I heard one of the kids say was that they thought that snorkeling was going to be this real technical activity, but that they were amazed at how easy it was to just get in and go snorkeling. I know that you guys have this snorkel trail in North Carolina, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about that.
The big driver behind us developing the Blue Ridge Snorkel Trail is there's all this really cool stuff to see in Western North Carolina. We have so much clear water. It gets clear really quick after it rains. I grew up in Indiana. You get the same amount of rain, you're probably not going to be able to see the bottom of the river for a week or two. We developed the Blue Ridge Snorkel Trail to try and find a way to make it easier for folks, because we kind of heard the same thing. I snorkel all the time for work. We're also over muscles, so it's all snorkel surveys. And we get exposed to all this awesome stuff that's there. Like, even our most common species are incredibly cool, and people just have no clue what we have. So we wanted to find a way to make it easier for folks to know where to go, what to do, what to see. The snorkel trails, it's not a linear trail like a hiking trail. It's more like the Bourbon Trail or something. We're inviting you to go get individual experiences at these different places and see what they have to offer. 2023 is when we opened up the trail. We had 10 sites. At each site, you have a kiosk. There's 10 highlight species we want folks to look out for. It's mostly fish, but we try and hit on some mussels and some crayfishes. You want common things you know people are going to see. You want some charismatic things that you want people to like know are there. And then I like to sprinkle in a few things that are pretty rare or endemic to, like, if they see this, I want to know about it. Mm-hmm. Or, for example, one of our first sites we did was on the Mills River. And the Mills River has a crayfish called the French Broad Crayfish. We have only have a couple records of them in the last like 10 years. I really want people to know that there's a French Broad Crayfish in your watershed. We have all these unique things that this is the only place you can see them. That's what we want people to think when they're going to these different sites. Hopefully encourage that kind of curiosity to see what we have to offer in Western North Carolina. I should mention all these sites are at free public access. You don't have to worry about permission. You know it's safe. People are already swimming at these places, and we're just trying to encourage folks to throw on a mask. Man, it was way more popular than we were prepared for. We've opened 2 more sites, and we actually have funding for 30 more. Virginia is opening up their first site here in a couple weeks. I'm hoping that it'll get other states like motivated to open their own sites, because definitely would love to see them in Georgia and Tennessee and even South Carolina.
It's going to be like the next Appalachian Trail. So coming from Alaska, this sounds really cool. I want to go see this fish that we're talking about. What should I do? When should I come? I want to see them when they're spawning, maybe some of those beautiful colors. What spot should I go to? What should I bring?
With spotfin chubs, the wonderful thing about them is that their spawning season's basically all summer long. The more comfortable water temperatures are, the more likely you're going to be able to find some really beautiful males. It's kind of like counter to some of these other species that are like spring spawners. The best time to really snorkel is when all the active chub mounds are going, but that's May, and most people are not necessarily built for mountain water in May. So unless you have a wetsuit, definitely can be a short-lived experience for some folks. But with spotfin chubs, they're going all summer long. So we have 2 snorkel trail sites that you can see them at: Queen Branch Preserve on the Little Tennessee River. It's a property that's owned by Mainspring Conservation Trust. They're one of the co-creators of the snorkel trail. It's right on the river. With permission, you can camp there. And then the Chioa River actually has a site too. And that's the one I definitely recommend, because rain or shine, you can find spotfin chubs in clear water there.
And what kind of footwear are you wearing? Like fins or grippy shoes or what?
You know, water shoes are fine as like a baseline, or old sneakers. I have some like Keen water shoes that are steel toe. I feel like that was just made for somebody to river. There's some hard rocks out there. You just want something with a little grip. Once you get in the water, most places you can just crawl around. And then all you need is a mask and snorkel and wet gear. One of our newest sites to open is Shelton Laurel in Madison County, North Carolina. There's a community center there that has a lot of really awesome folks dedicated to river conservation. They have wetsuits and snorkels they lend out for free for you to snorkel at their site. They have dedicated education room for the river. It's an awesome place. In the French Broad River watershed, we have a couple companies that do guided snorkeling trips now. I think there's a lot of folks that are just a little more hesitant and not as comfortable around water, and that's what those kinds of groups can do, is make it easier for folks to get more comfortable doing this stuff.
It's cool.
Pat, I'm curious, how did you first get involved with this fish?
Yeah, it was through Luke. Luke, I can't really remember how we originally met. Maybe you reviewed my collection paperwork. Is that accurate?
I think that's how it was. Is like Pat applied for a collection permits that are in my work area. Anybody that seems like I could collaborate with, especially if they seem like a nice person, I like nudge them like, hey, how about we do a little, you know, like, how about you move a little further west, or like, would you be interested in this? And I'm probably relentless, but Pat's been a good person to have on board, and he's nice when I throw my ideas at him.
At Wilson, we have this heavy emphasis on what we call experiential learning, so learning by doing, right? Given the fact that we have a conservation biology major and students want to get active experience in conservation biology, working on these types of projects where students can work alongside professional biologists is incredibly valuable for so many reasons, right? I mean, one, the hands-on experience of just learning the basic biology of these fishes, understanding what does conservation really look like, what do translocations look like, and then actually getting these students participating in this work in the field, in the lab, really provides just, I think, a wide range of experiences for students to learn beyond that traditional classroom setting. We are a work college, so the students who go here work on campus. We have an active farm, so we have a farm work crew, and we also have a biology work crew, and so we have students who are working on helping me with research when they can, and also students who are working on developing outreach materials. So, for example, we had a student make a really amazing paper mache spot fin chub mask that we're waiting to unveil at the most opportune time when we can do the chub fest again. You have some students who are painting some 3D models of darters so that we can have these nice sort of in-color models that children in particular can interact with and learn about the biology. I had a student last semester look at zooplankton because no one really looks at zooplankton in wadable streams. So we learned some new things about that. Some students doing microhabitat work with some local darter species, right? So all these questions that we can address through our students here at Wilson.
Yeah. Beyond the student body, is there a role for citizen science in what y'all are trying to do with this fish and maybe just some of the other fish found in the rivers in your neck of the woods?
The snorkel trail is key for that. Anytime that we can have observations and put extra dots on maps essentially is so helpful, especially for species we haven't seen in a while, right, that have been detected again through this.
As far as citizen science goes, I've done kind of the basic stuff like create projects on iNaturalist and to try and capture that information. And that's been good. One of the most important things is just knowing these things are there. Actually, surprisingly, it's paid off. Post Helene, one of the sites I've talked about already is the Mills River. There's widespread debris removal happening post Helene in all of Western North Carolina. In some cases, this can definitely damage habitat and definitely alter things in a way that's less than ideal, especially in areas that have sensitive species. But that Mills River site, there's a big river park there, really popular. And when they started planning for doing some debris removal there, they were really concerned about the mussels because there's a mussel found there called a slipper shell. They're basically our only good population we have is in the Mills River. They're barely anywhere else. They got the contractor in contact with me and we were able to go in there and work with them and coordinate to minimize damage happening at the site and move animals out of the way. There's a risk. And even when we were there, there were like a lot of people that kept on asking them, it's like, well, what about the mussels? What about slipper shells? What about, you know, Appalachian Elkdo, which is another federally endangered mussel we have around there? It definitely helped minimize damage post Helene just because people were aware of it and excited about it.
And I think now it's just really trying to get people on board as much as possible to participate in these types of conservation efforts so that we can have these very, very real outcomes of protecting our stream ecosystems and all the fishes that live in them.
Nice.
I was also going to ask you guys if you know Casper Cox. We had him on for Tangerine Darter, and man, he got us excited about snorkeling.
Thank you for bringing that up. Casper and Freshwater Illustrator, definitely a big part of our inspiration for creating the trail. Casper has his guide associated with that Hidden Rivers documentary. He is a graphic designer by day, so he actually came up with our logo and he designed our first 10 signs. He is very much part of the snorkel trail, and he's definitely had already a camping trip trying to hit as many snorkel trail sites as he can.
Okay.
This spring, he's a big part of it. We love Casper.
As we've been recording this, I've literally been having to ignore these dings on my phone that are texts from Casper.
Yeah. He's a wild man. When he gets going, he can't be stopped.
Anything else that y'all would like to mention? I know we're kind of at time here.
I think anybody out there like listening, maybe high school fish enthusiasts that are trying to find a cool place to go to college and get like hands-on experience, I definitely recommend Warren Wilson.
Thank you. I will return the favor because in my free time with my son, I love visiting the Blue Ridge Snorkel Trail sites. It's just such a fun way to connect with nature and to be able to share that with friends and family. I think that's also a really special thing. We think about West North Carolina and like all the wonderful hiking trails and bike trails. We also have these just wonderful areas to snorkel. And I know Luke's put a lot of effort into making these really, really accessible to people from all walks of life, as he mentioned.
Why should people care about the Spot Fin Chub? Why is it awesome?
You go first, Pat.
When you think about any of our favorite species, you could think about the millions and millions of years of evolution that have occurred that have led to our current fish species and communities present. And that alone, given the amount of time it's taken in the history of the planet to get there, I think that alone gives them really great value. And the spot fin chub, with all of its really unique morphological characteristics that have led to a lot of taxonomic confusion, that alone makes it a very unique component of our streams here in the southeastern United States.
Luke.
Yeah, and for me, it's just like spotfin chubs are just an incredible species. They're charismatic. Any of these species are just found a few places in the southeast and the upper Tennessee drainage. There's only a handful of places you can see them. We should definitely take ownership. This is ours, and we have the responsibility to keep it here. We can definitely do it, and just it takes everybody working together to do it.
Yeah, awesome.
Bernie Kahaida sure thought they were cool enough to put them on his southeastern Hawaiian shirt.
That's why I have $50 less than I do now.
Oh, man.
That's a good shirt.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you both so much. This was great talking with you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Actually, I wanted to thank you both, too. I've actually used your podcast in a class before last semester. I co-taught a class that compared the southeastern United States rivers to the Colorado River Basin.
Ooh.
And so when we were driving around, we eventually made our way to the hatchery in Grand Junction. And so we listened to the Colorado Pike Minnow and awesome. Razorback Sucker episodes to prep students.
Awesome. Glad they're getting
nice.
Used. Yeah. We'll get out there and live with, live from, discover, and enjoy all the fish, especially the spotfin chub. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. This podcast is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region. We hope you continue to develop your interest and love for America's fish and the beautiful places they live.
You're listening to Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Governor Mike Dunleavy's annual energy conference included visits from three of the Trump administration's top officials, but it didn't include any major developments on the financing of the proposed 800-mile Trans-Alaska natural gas pipeline. The Alaska Beacon reports, despite the conference's name, oil and gas development took top billing. The three high-level Trump officials said they hope to increase oil and gas production in Alaska under the direction of President Donald Trump. Despite the enthusiasm for the Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Pipeline, better known as the AKLNG, it still isn't clear who will pay for it to get built. Energy developer Glenfarne, which is pursuing AKLNG on behalf of the state, announced last week that 50 firms had formally expressed interest in AKLNG contracts worth more than $115 billion. Those contracts include possible supply agreements, people interested in selling things to AKLNG for construction, as well as possible investors. An expression of interest isn't a firm commitment, and no investor said last week that they will back the project. Officials have not yet publicly released the names of the two victims of the deadly helicopter crash near Dead Horse on the North Slope last week, but Jonathan Guibas has been identified by family as the pilot who died in the crash. Guibas was 54 years old. He started working at Wasilla-based Pollux Aviation about a month ago. According to family, Guibas was an experienced helicopter flight instructor, as well as a diving instructor and a licensed motorcycle technician. A recovery crew reached the site of the crash about 30 miles west of Dead Horse on Friday, according to the National Transportation Safety Board. State and federal officials are assisting with the investigation. A terrorist group based in Nigeria has kidnapped a Catholic priest who previously served in Alaska, according to the Diocese of Fairbanks. The diocese announced last week that Boko Haram reported they captured Reverend Alphonsus Afina. On Thursday, the Catholic faith-based Fetus News Agency reported that religious officials in Nigeria were able to speak with Afina on the phone after his capture and said he was in good health at the time of the call. Fairbanks Diocese Vicar General Robert Fath says Afina, who's from Nigeria, came to Alaska in 2017 on a religious worker visa. He says Afina and another reverend had shared stories about prior encounters with Boko Haram.
You know, they had experienced personally, prior to being here, attempts on their lives. They had seen churches burned, family and friends that were kidnapped and killed.
Boko Haram is a jihadist militant group. Before returning to Nigeria, Afina spent 6.5 years serving in Fairbanks and villages in western Alaska. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
North Rim Bank, helping power the businesses that power Alaska with customized solutions. More at northrim.com.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
You're listening to Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. More than 1,000 people from around the world gathered in Anchorage last week for the Alaska Sustainable Energy Conference. Across 3 days of panels and talks, the specter of the long-sought Alaska gas line loomed large. As KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara reports, the megaproject still faces a lot of outstanding question marks.
Sitting in gray armchairs with a large image of a moose behind them, Governor Mike Dunleavy and Glenfarn CEO Brian Duvall came together on the last day of the conference to reflect and ruminate on the literal pipe dream.
Okay, I'm going to ask the question that I probably shouldn't ask. Confidence level. Are we going to have a pipeline here in a few years?
Well, I see every reason why we will, and I've come here and I've put my name on it. And when I put my name on something, I'm stuck. I got to get it done. And the fundamentals allowed me to do that with good decision making, not rolling the dice. So the answer is yes.
Duvall says his company is taking the Alaska LNG project one step at a time. He's the founder and CEO of Glenfarn, which assumed majority ownership of the project from the state of Alaska earlier this year.
There are three phases. Each of them can reach their final investment decision, attract capital in independent financings. And so these are really bite-sized financings.
The three phases correspond to the three elements of the project: an 800-mile pipeline, a liquefaction and export facility in Nikiski, and a North Slope gas treatment plant. The project's been floated for decades, but the steep cost, $44 billion at last count, has stymied any real progress. Glenfarn recently announced Worley Limited as the company that will update the project cost to $2025. Glenfarn has a stated goal of bringing on investors by the end of the year. Also this week, the company announced a cohort of potential investors that Glenfarn says have, quote, expressed interest in the project. But what it really needs is buyers. U.S. Energy Secretary Doug Burgum suggested during a Sunday roundtable in Anchorage, investors will fall in line once buyers sign on.
If we sell energy to our Pacific allies, there will be people lined up to finance it. We won't take foreign capital to build the pipeline. There may be foreign interest in wanting to be part of it because it's going to be a great project. But what we really need is customers.
But as of Thursday, there aren't any offtake agreements. Not any binding ones, anyway. Earlier this year, Glenfarn and Dunleavy celebrated a letter of intent from Taiwan's state-owned CPC Corporation, signed while the governor toured Asia to promote the project. Penmon An, a high-level Taiwanese official, says the project is his country's, quote, best choice for building energy resilience.
More importantly, and another reason why I'm here today, the government of Taiwan is ready to expand its procurement of natural gas, agricultural goods, and industrial products from the United States. Alaska stands at the center of this endeavor.
If built, Men An said the project could become Taiwan's, quote, primary source of energy. But some, like Nikiski Republican Senator Jesse Bjorkman, say they're ready to see some tangible results.
Enthusiasm doesn't equal a decision to invest in a project, doesn't equal an agreement to have a project move forward that's going to benefit Alaskan. That's what I want.
Even Duvall agrees turning the pipeline dream into a reality is a tall order.
There's no doubt this is going to be really, really hard. and a lot of angst, but it really is a tremendous opportunity, and I invite everyone in the room to be part of it and step forward where you want to be involved.
He says his strategy is a simple one. Never give up. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
This is Alaska Public Media.
It's a beautiful morning.
Good morning, everybody out here in Southwest Alaska. Another day in paradise. Just beautiful today. I got to share this. I want to stay positive, but this is kind of negative. But I got to share it anyway. It's Friday. I didn't make an appearance. It was a tough weekend for me. I went into an emotional. I want to say emotional collapse. It was close. I pretty much slept all Friday and Saturday. Sunday, I came out of it. Have faith in the Lord, for one. I mean, it's like, I was praying, you know, please help me, Father. I've lost my faith. I've lost my hope. And all that went on. And anyway, Sunday, it just, everything came alive and I was fine. I apologize for not being here, but man, I haven't been knocked down in a long time. The cause was basically just gout. I mean, that's uric acid. But when someone has chronic kidney disease, the kidneys have to get rid of the uric acid, and it's pretty tough on them. So, you know, I guess I'm ready to check out and see what it's like on the other side as far as being happy and tight with my maker. There's no doubt about that. But man, I don't want to leave. It's gorgeous here. I mean, it really is, especially out here in Alaska. We have one of the most beautiful places there is. I might have to play another song to kind of display that. And give me a second to type this in. God, I misspelled Alaska. Can you believe that? That's really funny. Okay. And we'll take a listen to this because it's a great song. Thank you.
where I'm walking, way up on the mountainside. Flowers and snow, the sun doesn't set tonight. Look what I'm seeing, like pictures in some magazine. Glacier and stone, thunder to the bone. Yeah, she speaks to me, and I can't believe all the treasures I've yet to see, and all of the wonders waiting between. And I can't believe I've lost my heart to roam. Oh yeah, so I think I'll call Alaska my home, maybe just for a little while. I think I'll call Alaska my home. Can you hear what I'm hearing? The whisper of a mountain stream. We're miles from the road. Her silence bewilders me. Oh, but big winds are blowing, anger, warning sign. She's wild and untamed, ruthless in her games. Yeah, she'll make you bleed. And I can't believe all the treasures I've yet to see, and all of the wonders waiting between. And I can't believe I've lost my heart to roam, oh yeah, so I think I'll call Alaska my home, maybe just for a little while. I think I'll call Alaska my home. And small, these vistas they swallow you. Oh, these ridge lines are endless, they lead you right up to the sky, and the snow will lead you down with stars all around. Yeah, and the northern lights, and I can't believe all the treasures I've yet to see, and all of the wonders waiting between. And I can't believe I've lost my heart to roam, oh yeah, so I think I'll call Alaska my home, maybe just for a little while longer. I'll call Alaska.
Yeah, it was Midtown Revival with Alaska My Home. That was really done on one of our newscasts, and so I went to their website and downloaded it so I could play it on the radio. And great song. Coming up now, we have Loretta Lynn with The Other Woman, and then Leon Payne with I Love You Because. We're taking us to the top of the hour. After that, Leon McAuliffe with Panhandle Rag.
I'd like to introduce myself. I'm the other other woman, the other woman in your husband's life. The whole town's buzzing about us and our stolen moments. They're calling you the true and faithful wife. But you gave him the right to seek that other woman. And you know who was first to cheat on who. I just accepted love from him you never wanted. The other woman didn't steal from you. The judge who's wrong or right. Their whispers might be different if they knew what I know. The husband still beats you home every night. But you gave him the right to seek that other.
Love you 'cause you're you. Life is like a mountain railway with an engineer that's brave. We must make this run successful.
In God.